Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
It's done. It's finally done. And now I can breathe a sigh of relief here with you on the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. And if you've been listening to the podcast for the past 6 or 8 months, you know that I've been working on a new book, Why Catholics Can't Be Socialists, co-authored with Catherine Pakalik, who is a professor of economics at Catholic University of America. So this last Friday, I was furiously finishing up the manuscript to send off to Catherine for her kind of final review. Co-authoring is a lot of fun. You send the manuscript back and forth with one another. I did this with Layla Miller, actually, for our book, Made This Way, How to Prepare Kids to Face Today's Tough Moral Issues. The titles and the subtitles, by the way, as an author, if you read a book and you weren't a big fan of the title or the subtitle, don't entirely blame the author. The publisher usually comes up with that. But I was very happy, actually, with Catholic Answers Press, both with title, subtitle, and the cover of Made This Way. Though I think in the original cover, covers usually go through drafts. The cover of Made This Way has someone holding a paper cutout family on a block of wood. Before, you couldn't tell it was a block of wood. It looked like they were kind of standing in the ocean. So I was glad that we kind of got that fixed. So I'm looking forward to, of course, what the title and cover will be for Why Catholics Can't Be Socialists. So it was nice. I actually had a special getaway planned with my wife. Last Saturday, we got to go out, spend time with some family friends, and just be able to get away and have kind of a belated birthday and anniversary present. And it's always nice. I hate when things are hanging over my head. And whenever you write a book, at the very end of writing a book, it's like a monster living in your basement. When you first write a book, I think I've shared this quote before. It comes from, I think, Winston Churchill, or who knows where it comes from, but it's true. Like, when you first start writing a book, oh, it's fun, it's delightful, it's like a, you know, a pleasant hobby, or your mistress or something like that, not a literal mistress, but it's, you know, something pleasant and fun. Then as you get towards the end of the book, it's a slave driver, a tyrant. That's what it feels like when you've got the book. You're like, oh, I've got to get this finished. And it's always the tedious parts, the end notes, the layout, the formatting, making sure it flows and that it sounds right, everything comes together, and checking sources. So this book will be on the shorter end. It'll probably be a little bit shorter than my book Made This Way with Layla, but it still has about, oh gosh, over 300 endnotes, 300 citations in the book, because I care a lot in my books about making sure I've got evidence. And when I make a point, or I make an argument, or I say this is true, or this is what happened, or this is what the church teaches, that I can go to something beyond just my own opinion. Or when I cite a story or I cite something in history, I try to go back and find the historical evidence for that. And sometimes when I go through even writing my socialism book, I've seen things that have been in other Catholic books on this subject, and then I go and I dig a little bit deeper, and it turns out it's either not true or we don't really have good evidence for this papal quotation or this historical episode. And as much as I'd love to include it in the book, I have to drop it, because I'm only going to put out there what I believe that the evidence shows, which, by the way, if you're interested in my conversion story, you can get that from shop.catholic.com. It's called Following the Evidence. That's the name of my conversion story. It's finally available in a 2-disc series. And however, if you were a silver level subscriber to the podcast, silver level or higher, $10 a month or more, you get a free copy of my conversion story. And you also get to look at one of the chapters, a sneak peek of a chapter from the socialism book called Why Socialism Fails. Or I think it's called Socialism's Fatal Flaws. It's chapter 3 in the book. So if you want those bonus content and you want to help the podcast thrive and grow and reach more people, be sure to check out trenthornpodcast.com to become a patron who supports the podcast, or at the very least, consider leaving a review at iTunes or Google Play. So since the socialism book is finished, I thought it'd be very appropriate to talk about a video that's been going on around online. You may have heard clips from this. It is a little clip from the recent Democratic Socialist Convention. So one of the number one questions I get when Catherine and I wrote this book, Why Catholics Can't Be Socialists, they say, well, what about being a democratic socialist? And I'll say, well, it depends. What do you mean by that word, by that term? Because it means different things to different people. I will say that the people who belong to the Democratic Socialists of America, to the actual party, they seem basically to be communists by any other name. They're communists who want communism or socialism to be elected through the democratic process. And since the church uniformly condemns socialism, you cannot be a democratic socialist if what that means is you want socialism through the democratic process. Whether you impose socialism through tyranny or dictatorship or through democracy, it's still wrong. I mean, you can still get bad things from democracy, or you can get things you don't want through a democracy. There's the old story of two wolves and a lamb, and they voted on what's for dinner. It doesn't work out so well for the lamb. And when I listen to this of the dyed-in-the-wool democratic socialists, that's what it sounds like. So I want to play a few clips from you, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about what the church teaches about this, the historical roots of democratic socialism, and how we should consider it as Catholics today. So here's a little bit of a flavor of what the Democratic Socialist Convention was like a few weeks ago.
Quick point of privilege. Quick point of personal privilege.
Yes.
First of all, James Jackson, Sacramento, he, him. I just want to say, can we please keep the chatter to a minimum?
Yes, he did put out his preferred pronouns. So James Sacramento, he, him, if you're talking to me. And so you've got to say to everybody whatever their preferred pronouns are. What I really hope they do soon is, if I can have a preferred pronoun, I'd really like to have preferred adjectives. I would get to say, hi, Trent Horn, San Diego, California, your awesomeness. I guess that'd be more of a pronoun. Awesome, cool, tubular, radical. That would be 1990s trend, actually, wanting those adjectives. But yeah, so ask, if people can have preferred pronouns, why can't you have preferred adjectives? But then it goes on.
One of the people who's very, very prone to sensory overload, there's a lot of whispering and chatter going on. It's making it very difficult for me to focus. Please, can we just, I know we're all fresh and ready to go, but can we please just keep the chatter to a minimum? It's affecting my ability to focus. Thank you.
Thank you, comrade. Okay, is there a speaker against name?
Oh, and by the way, if you're trying to convince me that you're not trying to return, they're saying, well, democratic socialism is nothing like what they had at the Soviet Union. If you're trying to convince me of that, try not calling each other comrade. That might be a good start. But wait a minute, did you remember James Jackson, he, him, from Sacramento, he committed a cardinal sin in what he said. Do you remember what he said? The hurtful microaggression he threw out there in his reply, in his statement. He started by saying, hey, you guys. Now I'm thinking of Goonies. Hey, you guys. He said, you guys. Uh-oh. And then here's being called out for it.
Chapter pronouns.
Privilege. Point of personal privilege.
Yes.
Please do not use gendered language to address everyone.
Okay.
Oh, and by the way, people are clapping to that, like the room goes crazy, but you can't hear it because clapping is triggering for people. So in the wide shot, you just see people flittering their hands, kind of like jazz hands, because I have been to universities and given talks where to audiences that are not are hostile to what I'm saying. And when someone makes a point against me, like, you know, Trent Horn is a bigot, the Catholic Church is evil, I'll see people will either snap or do their little jazz hands. So I have seen this in person.
Point of privilege once again. Quick point of privilege once again. Hi, James Jackson, Sacramento DSA, he, him. I have already asked people to be mindful of the chatter of their comrades who are sensitive to sensory overload, and that goes double for the heckling and the hissing. It is also triggering to my anxiety. Like, the be comradely isn't just for, like, you know, let's keep things civil or whatever. It's so that people aren't going to get triggered and so that it doesn't affect their performance as a delegate, okay? Your need to express yourself is important, but your need to express yourself should not trump or over, like...
I see that no...
Point of privilege. You said Trump. That is a triggering word for me. That is a triggering word for me. Comrade, I can't... I'm not terribly worried about these people launching some kind of guerrilla revolution or something like that to take over our country and throw me into a concentration camp. It's like if these people come to my house to try to attack me, I'll just have to be like, Alexa, play Daft Punk really loudly. I can't handle the loud noises. So you've got a way to deal with them. So, I mean, you don't even need to use firearms to stop these people. If they were trying to fight you in a war, you just need like some firecrackers, basically. In fact, that's one of the comments under here on the YouTube channel. You know, you could stop these people in their tracks with firecrackers. My favorite comment, though, it's the most liked one, is, so this is what happens when South Park becomes live action. So, but what's interesting is that democratic socialism has a somewhat long history. It wasn't just invented last week at some Antifa rally in Portland. In order to understand it, you got to go back to the 1930s. So you have Dorothy Day, part of the Catholic worker movement, and she's trying to help the poor. And Day is interesting because she doesn't sound like many people today who help the poor, who believe in large government entitlement programs. For example, in 1944, she said of Social Security that it was a great defeat for Christianity. She believed that large government programs would give us an excuse as individuals to shirk our responsibility to love our neighbor. So she wasn't a fan of them, and she certainly was not a communist or a socialist as modern critics and even some Catholics try to label Dorothy Day. In fact, she called them out in an article in the Catholic Worker. She wrote saying that she opposed all dictatorships, fascist and Bolshevist. Bolshevist, of course, was the majority party in the Communist Party of the Soviet Union under Lenin. They were in a dispute with the minority labor party. The Bolshevists took power, and they eventually became the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. What changes is in the 1950s when one of Day's disciples, or someone who was involved in the Catholic worker movement, Michael Harrington, he's the one who founded more of what we consider democratic socialism. So he took a lot of these anti-poverty principles from the Catholic workers movement, but he said, all I knew of the Catholic worker when I walked into the House of Hospitality in 1951 was that it was as far left as you could go within the church. So Harrington eventually left the Catholic worker movement, and he left the faith entirely. He became an atheist. He wrote a very popular book called The Other America. And that was about poverty in the 1950s and 60s. Some people say that that book helped to spur Lyndon B. Johnson's war on poverty, but a lot of those claims, I think, are exaggerated. If it had any effect on LBJ's anti-poverty legislation, it would have been very negligible. But what it did help spawn were the Democratic Socialists of America. So Harrington did not like the way socialism was practiced in the Soviet Union. He didn't want a large state monopoly or the state owning all the means of production. Instead, he argued for, quote, decentralized face-to-face participation of the direct producers and their communities. So the current Democratic Socialists of America, they say on their website, they say, we are unlikely to see an immediate end to capitalism tomorrow. DSA fights for reforms today that will weaken the power of corporations and increase the power of working people. So the idea is that what they want for socialism is they don't want large government control or at least some democratic socialists of America. Now, what's hard is, as you'll see, what they say they believe and then what they argue for and they want are in opposition to one another. So they'll say, we just want decentralized sharing between people. So we don't want large government power. They don't want large corporations, no Walmart, no Amazon. They don't want any of that. They just want it. So they want to weaken the power of big government and large corporations. And one way they try to argue for that is they say, and I've heard other Catholics argue for this as well, saying that we shouldn't have large companies. We should just have small worker cooperatives. So either where workers share more in the income of the business, or that companies should be more worker-owned, that every employee has a direct stake in the company, and so every employee is also a co-owner of the company. In an article on NPR, one of the founders of a DSA chapter says this, saying how a worker cooperative would work. Let's say you were negotiating at a bargaining table with workers in a bakery. And the workers said, look, we want more than a quarter of the bread. We want half of the bread, or we want two-thirds of the bread. The socialist would say, actually, we want the bakery. We want to control it all for all of our benefit. Now, there's nothing immoral about starting a worker cooperative. In fact, the largest worker cooperative in the world is the Mondragon Corporation. It began in the Basque region of Spain, I think back in like the 1950s, and it employs over 100,000 people. And many of the employees also receive dividends from the company's stock, and they are kind of co-owners in the company. But even with Mondragon, which is the largest worker cooperative in the world and the oldest one, not every single employee is an equal co-owner in the corporation. Because if it were, if you had 100,000 people working somewhere and they all had equal leadership abilities in the company would completely fall apart. And there's a great example of this back in 2016 in Grand Rapids, Michigan, where a vegan restaurant that operated on self-proclaimed Marxist principles, including some of these worker cooperative principles, ended up failing. And it shows why, once again, there's nothing immoral. If you want to start a worker cooperative, that's fine. It becomes a problem if you say every single company in the world has to be a worker cooperative, because they can end up being very inefficient. As we can see in this article at Vice.com, Marxist vegan restaurant in Michigan closes for predictably Marxist reasons. This is back in 2016. After 5 years of business, Grand Rapids, Michigan's famously Marxist vegan sandwich shop is closing its doors due to bumps in the road toward what it hoped would be an egalitarian worker-run business. So unfortunately, the restaurant also proved the old adage that it doesn't matter how tasty your black bean patty is if you can't afford to pay your workers and it takes 45 minutes for you to put a sandwich together. So this restaurant, I mean, it's the classic. It was run by communists. It had murals of Che Guevara and Mao Zedong on the walls doing restaurant work, which is horribly ironic, of course. I love seeing modern Marxists idolize people like Che Guevara. For example, Che Guevara, after the Castro Revolution in the 1950s in Cuba, they set up military aids to production. These were concentration camps, and if you were a dissenter or the party in Cuba needed cheap labor, you got thrown into these camps. If you were a Jehovah's Witness, you got thrown into these camps. If you were a homosexual, if you identified as gay or engaged in homosexual behavior, you were thrown into these camps. In fact, Che Guevara said that homosexuality was indicative of bourgeoisie culture, that it's a perversion of the rich, and it's something a communist state would not tolerate. So I love seeing these university students who wear their Che Guevara t-shirts and their Cuba Castro hats at the same time promoting LGBT rights, except Che threw tons of people who identify as LGBT into concentration camps. Yeah, that's never talked about. Or Mao Zedong, Chairman Mao of China, working in a restaurant, which is ironic because Chairman Mao's policies started the Great Famine, part of the Great Leap Forward in the 1950s. It was like from 1958 to 1962. 30 million people in China died from a famine that was essentially caused by man-made policies, such as confiscating people's grain and focusing the country on building up industrialization. There were cases in China during this time where if your loved one died of starvation, they left the person in their bed and made it look like they were sleeping. That way, when the government officials came around to dole out the rations, you could say, oh yeah, grandma is asleep right over here. And he would give out the rations for the day, and then you would split the rations among your family. So it's brutal stuff. So what it says here, why the restaurant ended up failing, they said, unfortunately, in the Vice article, refusing to be a traditional business proved to not be very good for business. Not only did the cafe struggle to pay its workers, part owner, struggle to pay them, it swelled with comments from angry customers who routinely complained of slow and spotty service, saying that they would sometimes wait nearly an hour for what we're assuming was a very passable vegan sandwich. And that's when it was open. Thanks to a policy of setting hours by group decision, the cafe didn't keep standard hours, as some users noted. So that's the problem when you have these worker cooperatives. They're very small companies. Usually they only have about 10 employees. And when they're run in a cooperative way where you have to reach a decision by consensus, every single person in the company has to agree to it, you can never get any agreement. There's always, you know, one person who ends up disagreeing. And so it can be a very inefficient way to run a company. Or imagine if you're trying to ask for a raise. Instead of going to one boss in a worker cooperative, you have 10 employees, you have 9 other bosses that you have to talk to. So once again, it's not immoral. If you want to try to run that, fine. But most companies don't run that way because they're not efficient. They end up wasting the employees' time and money and the consumers' time and money. So that gets us back to the question then, can Catholics be democratic socialists? You can be a democratic socialist because that word has different meanings. Like over in Europe, there are democratic socialist parties. They're really like more liberal labor parties, and they just believe in strong union rights, for example. And Pope Leo XIII in Rerum Novarum talked about the dilemma of people who are working in very difficult jobs under very difficult circumstances, that they should be treated humanely and they ought to be paid a just wage. So Pope Leo XIII and Pope Pius XI both argued for a just wage for workers. However, they did not argue that this wage necessarily should always be imposed by some kind of central federal government. Because if you have one guaranteed minimum wage, it may not be the same kind of wage. Like the minimum living wage that you would need in New York City is way different from what you're going to have in Tulsa, Oklahoma, for example, or in El Centro, California. I mean, the living standards, what you need to make to get by in San Diego, California, is way different than El Centro, California, which is just 90 minutes away. I know we were wondering when we first moved here, gosh, how are we going to afford to live here in San Diego? And we've managed to get by and make it work. But we even thought, should we just, I don't know, live in El Centro and I just drive 90 minutes to the Catholic Answers office every day? There's some people who do commute in that way. So if you're just talking as if you, democratic socialism is just a way of saying, well, I believe in strong workers' rights and the protecting the dignity of workers, making sure they're working under fair, safe conditions, then that's fine. But guess what? You don't need to call yourself a socialist. In the 1960s, I think it was 1963, Pope John the 23rd put forward an encyclical, Mater et Magistra. And this is what he said about socialism. He says that Pope Pius the 11th, writing 30 years earlier, further emphasized the fundamental opposition between communism and Christianity and made it clear that no Catholic could subscribe even to moderate socialism. The reason is that socialism is founded on a doctrine of human society which is bounded by time and takes no account of any objective other than that of material well-being. Since, therefore, it proposes a form of social organization which aims solely at production, it places too severe a restraint on human liberty, at the same time flouting the true notion of social authority. And Pope Pius XI says the same thing, that if you want to be an apostle to socialists, don't be a socialist, be a Christian, that the ideals that socialists put forward that are true are also found in Christian morality. So it's redundant at best and villainous at worst if socialism, democratic or moderate socialism, slides into true socialism or communism, which socialism and communism are not separate belief systems. Communism is the ideal where you have no classes, and socialism is a stop on the road to get to communism. Communism, no rich, no poor, no workers or bosses, no citizens or government officials. We're all just happy-go-lucky in a classless society. It's communism. To get to communism, you have to stop socialism first and have a government that enforces mandatory equality among people. So the problem is nobody can ever get to true communism because socialism just doesn't work. And neither does democratic socialism in its true form when it's really a Trojan horse for traditional socialism. Neil Meyer, writing in Jacobin Magazine, which is a full-blown socialist publication, by the way, Jacobin Magazine, Bhaskar Sunkara just wrote a defense of socialism, which we critique in the book. He's talked in Jacobin about how we need to abolish private property. They're very upfront about that. So Meyer says, democratic socialists simply, quote, want to build a world where everyone has a right to food, health care, a good home, and a rich education, and a union job that pays well. Here's the thing, capitalists believe that as well. Those who believe in a free market believe that people should have a right to all these good things. The question between capitalism and socialism is not how involved the government is. Government is always going to be involved in our economic exchanges. It upholds our contracts. It makes sure that people keep to their promises. You know, when you hire someone to do something and they take your money and run, you have to have recourse if a contract is broken. So there's no such thing as pure laissez-faire capitalism. Government is always going to be involved in some way. The question is, who will be involved in creating and producing goods and services? Will it be private firms and companies under various government regulations, or will it end up being the government itself? In fact, Pope St. John Paul II said in Centissimus Annus, paragraph 48, he actually talks about the idea of providing a right to work, that Meyer says democratic socialists believe that government, eventually they believe government should provide this, a union job that pays well, that no matter who you are, how skilled or unskilled you are, you should be able to get a union job that pays well. John Paul II said in Centissimus Annus, the state could not directly ensure the right to work for all its citizens unless it controlled every aspect of economic life and restricted the free initiative of individuals. So once again, another one of the problems with socialism pops up. Another problem that comes up with socialism is there's this weird objection to labor itself. That the Democratic Socialists of America, for example, they say, a long-term goal of socialism is to eliminate all but the most enjoyable kinds of labor. Like, their goal, the goal of most socialists that I have read, is to get rid of almost all kinds of labor except the kind we all really just like doing. And guess what? If you really like doing it, but it involves work, it's not labor. It's a hobby. You know, hiking takes a lot of work. Fishing takes a lot of patience and work. Woodworking takes a lot of labor. And if you really enjoy it, though, it's not really labor. It's a hobby. Now there's lots of labor that people do enjoy. I love my job, but there's a lot of labor that's involved. When I sit down here, and what's funny is there's different kinds of labor. It's really hard to do roofing or to do manual labor. But I remember somebody who went from a hard manual labor job to an office job, and he quit the office job 8 months later because he said it was too hard. That just sitting at a computer and working was too burdensome for him. He would rather be out working in the sunshine and fresh air. It's kind of like the end of Office Space. You remember the end of Office Space? Please give me my stapler back, or I will burn the building down. Please, I need my stapler. And then Milton ends up burning the company down. And the main character, who thought he was going to get fired, the company's burned down. He ends up working for a construction crew, and he's working in the sunshine and fresh air and enjoys that. So we see this not just a recent phenomena. Paul Lafargue was Karl Marx's son-in-law. And he wrote a small little book that, wouldn't you want your son-in-law to write this book? The booklet was called, it's not even a book, it's more of a booklet. And you'll see why there's not a lot of effort put into it, because the booklet's title is The Right to be Lazy. That's right, Karl Marx's son-in-law wrote a booklet called The Right to be Lazy. Boy, we'd be happy for your daughter to snag somebody like that. But I guess if your dad is Karl Marx, then the fruit hasn't fallen very far from the tree. And he talks in there about how people should not have to work hard. He says, Jehovah, the bearded and angry God, gave his worshipers the supreme example of ideal laziness. After 6 days of work, he rests for all eternity. Well, Lafargue missed John 5:17, where Jesus says that my Father is still at work. God isn't just sitting on his throne since the seventh day of creation, not doing anything. He rested on one day, not that he has to, God's all powerful, but to be a model for us that we ought to rest from our labors one day a week so that we can worship him and enjoy the creation that he's given to us. And you see the same thing in the 2019 Green New Deal. There was a summary of it on, I think it was on Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's congressional website. It's not in the deal itself, but it was on a summary saying that the government should provide opportunities for people who either should provide an income or support for people who cannot work or are unwilling to work. And it was decried in the media, it was lampooned, and it was eventually taken down. But that's the mindset, that you have people within the socialist movement think that if we can just get enough robots to work for us, if we can just get enough together, none of us will ever have to work hard again. But that's not right. Pope Leo XIII in Rerum Novarum, this is what he says about bodily labor. He says, as regards bodily labor, even had man never fallen from the state of innocence, he would not have remained wholly idle. But that which would then have been his free choice and his delight became afterwards compulsory, and the painful expiation for his disobedience. Cursed be the earth in thy work, in thy labor thou shalt eat of it all the days of thy life. So what Pope Leo XIII is saying is that even if we had never fallen into sin, we still would have engaged in labor, even difficult labor, but we would not have experienced the toils that we experience here in this life. We still would have worked. But even in this life where we experience toil, that can be an opportunity for us to become fully human. Now, as we point out in the book, just because work as fallen beings, we're going to have to work and it's going to be difficult, that does not mean we have to put up with any kind of working condition. In Rerum Novarum, Pope Leo XIII says that factory owners should not grind their employees into dust. You know, he shouldn't work them so hard that they lose their humanity. So there's always a balance between exploiting people through work, which is wrong, which treats them as mere commodities and is inhuman, and saying that work itself is some kind of evil, which it's not, or having some kind of fanciful delusion that it's going to be like Star Trek, that, you know, we can just magically create all of the products that we need and none of us are going to have to work. But even on the Enterprise, people had to work. There's still going to be positions for people. And that brings me to the last thing that I want to talk about when it comes to the issues of work and socialism and a policy proposal that intersects them. And that's the idea of universal basic income. So you have people like Elon Musk who promote this idea. The most famous person right now who's promoting basic universal basic income is Andrew Yang. His first name is Andrew, I think. So I think it's Andrew Yang. And Yang is proposing, if you listen to the previous Democratic presidential debates, if he's elected president, he wants to give every single American adult over the age of 18, $1,000 a month, no strings attached. So that's the idea of universal basic income, is this idea that the government gives every single person a set amount of money. And different proposals put the money at different values, but Yang puts it at $1,000 a month for every single adult in the United States. I'm going to play a clip from the recent Democratic presidential debate, and I think Yang has actually qualified for the third and fourth debates in the fall. He has a significant following. He's met the donor threshold, and he's polling at least at around 2%. So he's got a significant number of people who are supporting this idea. I mean, when you tell people they're going to get $1,000 a month, no questions asked, people are interested. So let me play just a clip, though, of how he answered the question about this proposal in the Democratic debate, and then I'll give you my thoughts on universal basic income.
Mr. Yang, your signature policy is to give every adult in the United States $1,000 a month, no questions asked.
That's right.
I think that's like $3.2 trillion a year. How would you do that?
Sorry?
How would you do that?
Not off to a promising start, but I'm hoping maybe Yang just did not hear the moderator, but he just heard him and gave a reply. So this should be very clear. How in the world are you going to pay for this? It's going to cost $3 trillion a year.
Oh, so it's difficult to do if you have companies like Amazon, trillion-dollar tech companies, paying literally zero in taxes while they're closing 30% of our stores. Now, we need to put the American people in position to benefit from all these innovations in other parts of the economy. And if we had a value-added tax at even half the European level, it would generate over $800 billion in new revenue, which combined with the money in our hands, it would be the trickle-up economy from our people, families, and communities up. We would spend the money and it would circulate through our regional economies and neighborhoods, creating millions of jobs, making our families stronger and healthier. We'd save money on things.
So then he goes on and explains that you'll pay, and I love politicians when they're asked, how are you going to pay for this program? And then they say, well, here's the thing, we're going to save this amount, we're going to save this amount, we're going to save this amount. Okay, so you're not spending Y, but you still have to come up with X to actually pay for the program. How are you going to do that? It's like when I go home, we're driving, my wife and I are going to be driving, you know, we'll see at a fast food restaurant, you know, buy one Big Mac, get one free. And I'm like, well, my goodness, I don't want to lose money. I can't just not go here. Do you have the money to buy this Big Mac? Well, here's the thing. The $4 for the Big Mac, we're going to save $4 in the other Big Mac. So we're already saving $4 right away. And if I eat a lot, I won't have to eat later. So we're basically making money. I'll have one Big Mac. And what the heck? I'll have a large fry. And, you know, I will try that Stroop Waffle McFlurry, actually. Oh, my gosh. How did I end up spending $16 and get sad and take a nap? So I love when people do that. But the idea, now it's interesting, Yang's proposal focuses on a value-added tax, which is a fancy way of saying that throughout the supply chain of a product, whether it's, let's say you grow an apple in the farm and it's sold to a factory that makes apple juice, and the apple juice is sold to a distributor, and the distributor sells it to retailers like Target. At every point along the way, when the apple is sold to the factory, when the factory sells it to the distributor, and when the distributor sells it to the retail store, there is a value-added tax where the government just places a tax in there on the increased value of the item. And Yang believes that his VAT, now other economists will come forward and say, well, no, it couldn't be half the level of European VATs or VATs. It would have to be twice as much will pay for the program. But that's assuming a lot of things. First, it's assuming that you also won't be affected by companies raising their prices when they have this tax increase. They're always going to pass that along to the consumer. So, you know, okay, great, I get an extra $1,000 a month, but what happens if a lot of goods and services go up 10 or 20% in value? You know, the money just ends up shifting hands. It doesn't really go towards benefiting people. Second, the other thing that the proposal doesn't take into account is that some people, if they're given $1,000 a month, will become less productive. So if they don't produce more into the economy, then we're going to see contraction in economic growth, at least in some sectors. So he's right that not a lot of people, $1,000 a month for almost everybody is not enough to live on, or at least it's not a lifestyle that you would want. It would supplement people's income. But Yang is assuming that if people get $1,000 a month, they will immediately go out and buy stuff at Target, or they're going to buy stuff in the economy, they're going to spend it at mom and pop stores, and that's going to boost the economy. But the problem here is that in previous stimulus packages, when people are just given a check, a lot of people, when they get a check from the government, they either use it to pay off debt like credit card or student loan debt, or they put it into savings, which doesn't provide stimulus to the economy and reach those kinds of end goals. Of course, those are areas of prudential judgment. You might be a listener who supports Andrew Yang's policy. I am not saying that there's a Catholic teaching on this particular policy. Catholics can reasonably disagree about different ways to help the poor, whether we should use charities, whether we should use traditional government welfare programs, whether we should use universal basic income. And we need to have debates and discussions about which policies are most prudential, which ones are the most rational way for us to achieve the good. Rather, my biggest objection to universal basic income, what I'm concerned about, is this idea that it undermines the dignity of work, of thinking that our end goal is to create a world where everyone is provided for either by a small minority of workers or by robots or something like this, and people don't have to work. But at the end of the day, work is something that is dignifying to us. It's how we serve our fellow man. And I would recommend that you read Pope St. John Paul II's encyclical on this, Laborum Exercens. In fact, I'll list it in the show description at trendhornpodcast.com, along with the resources I discussed in this episode. And that wherever you are, whatever you're listening to right now, whatever work that you're doing, whether it's in the office or it's at home, I hate the idea that, you know, the phrase, or I'm sorry, to be more precise, the question to moms at home, oh, are you going to work? Hey, if you're a mom that's at home, you're working pretty hard. I watch the kids for 2 hours, and I understand how hard it is. That's why I'm grateful to my lovely wife, who tends the children, helps them to grow up to be fully functional, well-developed human beings who will continue to spread the gospel of Jesus Christ here in the world. Thank you guys all so much for listening. Be sure to go check out trendhornpodcast.com for the resources for this show and bonus content if you're a subscriber. Thank you guys so much, and I hope that you have a very blessed day.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit trendhornpodcast.com.